The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a special edition of The Heretics Hour on this Monday, December 16th, 2013. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm pleased to introduce you to three gentlemen whose names you will no doubt recognize, but only two of them are with me right now. We're waiting for the third one to call in. I guess he'll call after, you know, you can still call once the show is going. And so we're ready to discuss this long-running control that Mark Weber has exercised over the Institute for Historical Review and the damage that has occurred by his control. In counter alphabetical order this time, I welcome first, the one who's not here is Guillermo Rudolph. We're waiting for him to call in. So, until he does, he may be having some family things to deal with. Next in alphabetical order is, a radio show host from Renegade Broadcasting Network, who had Mark Weber as a guest on his program on December 4th when Weber answered an important question. And he is Dana Rocapriori. Hi, Dana. And did I pronounce your name right?
Yeah, you nailed it. Perfect.
Aha. Well, I'm good. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Dana. And I'm not hearing any more background sound. So I guess everything, that's good. So, and finally, longtime revisionist who experienced firsthand the ups and downs at the IHR, who opposed Mark Weber at the time, and whose popular website is NaziGassings.com on the World Wide Web. So welcome, Fritz Berg.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn.
Okay, and your actual name is Friedrich Paul Berg, but we're going to be calling you Fritz.
Right.
Tonight. All right. Well, I'm really glad that you're here. And so I'm ready to go with some good content here. And before we really get started into that, I want to point out that this month of December 2013 is the 35th anniversary of the IHR. And I wonder why there is no celebration at the IHR. There's no acknowledgement of this at their website. What do you have to say about that, Fritz?
Well, I don't know the reason for that. Perhaps Mark Weber is trying to separate himself from the way the IHR was going for many, many years until about 1995 when he became the chairman of the board and in addition to director of the Institute. In those early years, I think the IHR did a great job in breaking through this wall of ignorance that was out there, and it gained a lot of attention and gained interest from all around the world. But when Weber really took over I think it was 1995. I could be wrong about the exact year. I'm sorry about that, but he pushed that institute on a downhill track, and it came to a real screeching halt in 2002 when it stopped all publications, as far as I know, and all even semblance of interest in Holocaust revisionism. So,
well, right. Now, let me stop you right there and get back to this 35th anniversary. I mean, I was kind of surprised. I don't know how I figured that out, but I was looking, I guess, at something about, oh, it was that, you know, it started in, it started in December. It was the first month that, of operation or something. It was in December of 35 years ago, whatever that date was.
Of 1978 or 79?
One of those.
Okay.
And so, yeah, whatever adds up, right? I can't do that right at the moment. Well, I'm thinking about this too. So, but it was, you know, I mean, 35th anniversary is a pretty good, you know, it's a nice round number. And, I've never seen him celebrating anything. I don't remember any 30th anniversary. So, yeah, it's like he doesn't want to remind people of anything like that. of the past, you know, of how long it's been going and maybe what might have happened. Because it may be, and let's ask Dana now, have you had awareness, Dana, of the past of the IHR, of all the things that took place, or are you just learning that now?
I'm trying my best to brush up on the history.
Well, it's not brushing up now. I mean, you know, you would never have thought about what went on at the IHR.
Yeah, no, I know what the IHR is, but I don't know anything about the internal dynamics of the organization, the history of the leadership, and, you know, all the different developments that have happened throughout the years. I paid attention to the material put out by the IHR, and, you know, I would read their website and occasionally listen to a speech, and that's about as far as I go. You guys probably know a lot more, well, you definitely know a lot more about it than I do. I'm just here to present, I guess, a little balanced opinion in defense of Mark Weber, because, I don't know, it's just my personal stance that I believe, you know, I don't like to ever attack anybody who is exposing the Jews. That's kind of my personal feeling. Now, I realize everybody doesn't get along in this movement in Holocaust revisionism. You know, there are conflicts. Obviously, we wouldn't be talking about this tonight. But, you know, no, to answer your question, I don't have all of the details as you guys do. But I'm going to try and argue to the best of my ability here. So.
Oh.
Let me mention here to Fritz, can you move your mic a little bit further away from your mouth or something?
Oh, further away. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you moved it up because we were talking about how loud you
were. How does that sound? Is that any better?
Yeah, well, you sound fine. I mean, I was just like hearing breathing noises or something.
Oh, okay.
Are you moving your headset around or anything?
I am a little bit because someone is trying to call me on my regular home telephone, and I don't know what to do about it right now. Anyway, go ahead. Let's.
Yeah. That's what I was hearing is moving your headset. So try not.
Okay.
So let's go on with Dana here. Do you think it's strange that Mark is not celebrating any of these anniversaries? Do you think that was kind of strange of the organization?
Well, have they had, I mean, have they celebrated the anniversaries in the past?
I've never noticed it, but I would imagine that back when, Fritz, back when? In the 80s and 90s, what did they make any?
I'm not aware of any such celebrations or anniversaries. We were pretty much focused on just getting by and doing what work we could.
Yeah, but don't you think somewhere somebody would have said, written about, well, this is our, you know,
they
our
may have, but
or something.
They may have, but I don't know of anything like that, like a 10th anniversary or something like that. I'm not aware of anything like that at all. The beginning was a bit problematic, as you can imagine. I mean, it wasn't as if you know, there was a big opening celebration or anything like that. It was a matter of, you know, a journal coming out and maybe some small amount of publicity being generated in the Spotlight, which was the newspaper that Willis Cardo ran at that time out of Washington. So there was no big opening days, as one might imagine. But there could have been some celebrations, but I'm not aware of anything like that.
Okay, well, I'll move on then to the other thing that I find kind of strange, and that is that the last IHR event, you know, on their website there is a menu at the top, and one of the menu items is events, so you go there. And the most recent event that they have on there is from April 2011. And it was an address by David Irving and Mark Weber addressing some California meeting, it says. But, you know, not a big deal. But that was the last event, 2011. That's pretty sad.
Right.
Yeah.
And even that event was pretty sad, as far as I'm concerned, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, too, because you have to go all the way. And yet, Mark always says in his fundraising letters that, you know, amongst the things that they do that they need money for are events. And he says they're always doing events, but there's nothing on there. They must be so small that they can't even, you know, he has a little meeting once in a while and puts out little refreshments and I don't know what they do, but not too many people come, and so they don't want to call that an event, I guess. But you have to go all the way down the page to the IHR conferences. There's some better events as you go down. But then he has all the IHR conferences listed, starting in 1979, but only the last four of them, in 2004, 2002, 2000, and 1994, have a hyperlink to them, so you can go to a page. Here's Guillermar calling in. All right, I have to get over to my Skype page. All right, the white network. Okay, hope he holds on there. Eight. I knew he would eventually show up. Well, what happened? Did I do something wrong? He's still... Okay. Wait a minute. Hold on. Two. He must have hung up right then. 4-0. There.
Carolyn, while you do this, can I ask your other guest a question?
Sure.
Well,
I don't know why this is not working.
Well, I'm here now.
There you are. It is working. Yes.
Yeah, it is working indeed. I apologize for that. But I...
Well, I'm just glad you're here now. I figured you would show up. You know, things can happen.
Yeah, three little kids. And we had a visitor today that I was not expecting. I had forgotten about her. And so things got derailed. Anyway, here we are.
All right. Well, I want to do my introduction of you, Guillermar, because I had an introduction for everybody, and I just kind of skipped over yours. I said we might call you Mr. Revisionism, as you are almost single-handedly responsible for a very large part of the Holocaust revisionist books that are now available to us. And, of course, you've written a few of your own. Of course, we're talking about Guillermar Rudolph. I want to thank you for coming on, Guillermar.
All right, thank you. Some of the credits you gave me, I actually have to pass on to Carlo Martonio. If you look at the list of authors of the series of books that I have started and edited for a long stretch, I think for the 25 volumes we have, 15 of them have Carlo Martonio on them. So,
I didn't mean you wrote them all, but I meant that... Yeah. You know, you were helping get them published, I think.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have already talked about, I brought up that December 2013, this month, is the 35th anniversary of the IHR. And because it started in December 35 years ago. So, but there's not one single mention of it. And I was saying I was surprised that there wouldn't, you know, be an acknowledgement, not maybe a big party celebration, but something, you know, saying this is our 35th year, but nothing like that. And Fritz thought that he didn't remember it ever being done. And I don't know. I guess I should introduce you to Dana, who is Dana Roccapriori, who is the... is a show radio host on Renegade Broadcasting Network, and he had Mark Weber as a guest on December 4th when Weber did finally answer a pretty important question, and we'll get into that later. So, Dana, meet Guillermar.
Hi, Guillermar. It's an honor to be on with you and your other guest, Carolyn, and to be on the White Network itself. I'm very happy to be here, and I appreciate everything you guys have done to spread the truth out there. And Carolyn, I mean, I would respond by saying, you know, maybe they shouldn't be celebrating because you know, so many Americans still believe in the lies perpetuated by the Jewish media and, you know, just the constant 6 million figure that you find tossed around. I mean, so we've got an uphill battle ahead.
So we should stay quiet and they should be quiet. What do you think about that, Guillermo? Do you think that is a valid reason or good idea?
Well, I could come up with a host of reasons why they shouldn't celebrate, and some of them probably would not be very nice. But let's talk about more serious issues here. Why should they celebrate? Do they have anything to celebrate? I don't know how the whole issue is going to be approached by you here, but I think Fritz has the most experience of us all with the IHR because he has been a part of it on and off as a contributor, as a observer, for almost as long as the Institute exists, if I'm not mistaken. And I came into the game much later as an observer initially, and then I got my intellectual swords cross with the staff at some point where I got an insight into what's going on or what's not going on, and had my own conclusions derived from that. I don't want to go into that yet. I would say, chronologically speaking, since Fritz has the longest experience with it, maybe he wants to have the first word of how
it's
started.
He's been speaking. Yeah, he's been speaking. And he did make some comments. But I was just trying to kind of start out with the failure, you know, the failures of the IHR. I had said right before you called that the last IHR event that's listed on the website under events was from April 2011, and it was just a meeting there in California. Well, David Irving was there. Irving and Weber talked. They spoke about, they gave a talk each about Heinrich Himmler and Joseph Goebbels, you know, that kind of thing. So there's not much going on. That was my point. And so I would like you can just chat, ask Fritz, whatever you want, and you two can...
Well, let me. Okay. I'll try to say something
okay.
that I think is important. From the very beginning, the IHR was intended to be primarily focused on the Holocaust hoax. There was no doubt about that. Everybody understood that. Mark Weber understood that as well. And it's only been after 2002, after the IHR got probably its last big pile of money from various estates, that the direction was changed very, very dramatically by Mark Weber, entirely by himself. He changed the direction of the IHR from a Holocaust revisionist publishing organization to whatever it is today. I don't even know how to describe it anymore. But certainly Mark Weber is no Holocaust revisionist at all. And this is really outrageous and inexcusable on his part, because he has benefited enormously over nearly the whole length of that period of nearly 40 years now from people who were persuaded by him that he, Mark Weber, was somehow going to be the ultimate Holocaust revisionist. He was working for 10 years, supposedly, on the definitive book about the Holocaust. He was fed and dined and housed by a supporter in Nebraska and given free use of a telephone and all kinds of other things to write this great definitive book about the Holocaust. And yet, what did he produce? Nothing. Nothing. But gradually, he managed to maneuver himself into a position of power at the IHR. He took over the IHR and changed the entire direction. That is, to my mind, absolutely disgraceful. But technically, I'm not sure one can say that he did anything wrong legally, okay? But it's just so unethical and immoral what he has done. And it's also, I think, rather stupid, because today he's pretending that the Holocaust really did happen, that people were killed in gas chambers and so forth. It's just dumb beyond words as far as I'm concerned. I have trouble responding to that.
Well, you know, I have I forgot what I was going to say now. But you're right that I think it's a moral question. I agree. I don't know any legal problems involved. I don't know anything legally.
Well, the legal issues are 20 years ago when we had this huge federal estate being bequeathed to the IHR, formerly Caro, who was running the IHR from the background, claimed it was actually made out to him, and he made the lady formally donate it to the IHR because it's tax exempt, that's better. And then, you know, I always say if you want to ruin a small non-profit organization, give it a lot of money, then fights break out over the money and the whole thing falls apart. And that's what's happened with the IHR and everything around it. Now, legally speaking, legal is what the courts decided. The courts have decided that Weber and the IHR were right and Carter was wrong. That's the legal issue. That's the end of that discussion. The moral issue is that after that, Weber pretty much ran the whole thing into the ground, whereas Carter restarted whatever he could. And is still producing. Now, one can argue about the quality and the direction of what he's doing, but at least he's doing. Now, I spoke briefly about my experiences, and I have mentioned them here and there, but never really conclusively and in a summary in a podium like we have here now. So I would like to do that.
Great.
Even though I have been advised numerous times by Arthur Butts that I shouldn't kick a dead horse. Now, of course, it isn't dead. So he's talking about the IHR and Weber. But he isn't dead. He's alive and kicking and sucking up a lot of money from idealist supporters who think he's doing something good. Well, maybe he is in their eyes. It's not for me to decide. And the question is also on that, so what we should perhaps discuss later on, what's the alternative? But coming to my experience first, that I had with him. I remember when I put out my first full-fledged book that is also today part of the Holocaust Handbook series. That was in 98. It was the German edition of the Majdanek book, book on the Majdanek concentration camp. Mm-hmm. The Carter somehow got a hold of a copy of it, and they approached me and said, why is that not being published in English? Who is publishing it in English? Can't you do it in English too? And at that time, it was just a few years in England. I think for 2 years I've been in England, so my English wasn't perfect. I couldn't have possibly done anything in English then, so I thought, no, I can't do it. Why don't you do it? Now, the Carters at that time were struggling legally still with the IHR and were constantly facing bankruptcy and this and that. They couldn't do it. And the question was, why wasn't Mark Weber doing it? And that is a question that came to my mind back then, and then I started publishing more books, one on the concentration camp Stutthof, then one on Raoul Hilberg, and the next one was the big one, Dissecting the Holocaust, translated into English, that I actually wanted to put out in English. That was the first one, and the one that's to start the series in English. And during the preparation of that all, I had received an invitation from the IHR to speak. I had received numerous of them the years before, but I never had an opportunity to go for numerous reasons. I got stuck in England, in Germany, and later in England, couldn't really travel. But then I took the opportunity in the summer of 99 to get to America, meet a couple of people, and one of them, or a number, more than a couple, one of them was also the IHR staff, and primarily there, Mark Weber. And at that time, I had been publishing my German magazine, the Quarterly for Free Historical Research, in the third year it was then. And we had managed to get quite a few interesting, thoroughly researched papers by engineers, by other kinds of scientists and experts on a broad variety of topics that definitely needed to be published in English too. And now the Journal of Historical Review, that's the IHR's outlet at that time, was the perfect place to do that. But they never advanced me, and all the offers I had made, they just didn't have any feedback. So I took the opportunity then to ask Mark Weber, why aren't you trying to get any of the papers that we have in the German language in these magazines published in English? And his response then was, well, most of these papers are too technical, too narrowly focused, too difficult to understand for the non-expert reader, and therefore they would not be suitable for the Institute for Historical Review's readership, for the Journal for Historical Review. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, we have others too that are more general in nature, more for the broader public. I tried at that time always to keep it balanced, to have something for everyone, for the experts, for those who want to dig deeper, and for those who want more to have overviews or even a little bit of entertaining stuff. And I asked him, why don't you take any of these lighter issues? Well, these are too light, too superficial, and we can't do them either. I said, well, if you take those out for this reason and the others for the other reason, then there's nothing left. And that sounds to me like an excuse not to having to give credit to other sources or get down to work to get the translations done. What is the reason? Why are you blocking every single channel here? And he was just laughing at me and said, well, it just couldn't be done that way. And I couldn't believe it, the way he reacted. And I didn't actually expect my reaction to it, because I said them into his face, step down and let me take over the IHR. You are not doing a good job. And then he laughed out hard then, and just, that was the end of it. But at that point, I realized this guy is sabotaging the publication of good revisionist material for the sake of, I hadn't figured it out why yet, for the sake of what. But I realized it a little later, because he realized that he was under pressure, not just by me, but there were a lot of people out there who thought there is good material published in my German language magazine. It should be put into English. So what he did at the end was to take a paper that, or several papers that had appeared on, or two papers that were, on the high frequency delousing devices that had been installed in Auschwitz. That is, in plain English, the Germans, just prior to World War II, had stumbled over microwave technology, had developed it into the war, into a technology that could actually operate, and they built the first microwave ovens, and at that time, they built the first prototypes for the purpose of disinfesting soldier clothes at the Eastern Front to fight typhus and other diseases. And instead of deploying them at the Eastern Front, because they had constant problems in Auschwitz with epidemics, they decided to get them to Auschwitz to fight lice there, to save the inmates' lives. And that's how all this technology showed up in archives and in the paperwork that revisionists are interested in. And then an engineer got his hands on it and wrote papers, and they were published in my magazine. And Mark Weber then insisted that not the papers as such be translated and published. Again, too technical, too specialized, too uninteresting for the IHR readership. He insisted that he himself, under his own name, write a summary. And that's the only thing he would let pass. So no credit to the original engineers and authors, and no knowledge given to the English readership of what depth and breadth of research and research results have been done. Only Mark Weber's summary was allowed. And I've seen that with a number of people who had written papers. It wasn't good enough for Mark Weber for this or that reason, because his name wasn't on it, because not somebody revisionist Big Shot's name was on it. He would always place papers written by Florence and Butz on the Big Shots that are already acknowledged as revisionists. The flagships, he would let them in, but anything new, no. Anything too technical that he didn't understand.
It. He would rewrite it and put his own name on it without credit to the...
Yeah, well, some authors let this happened to them says, but most have their own ego and say, no, I've done the work for it. I want my name on it, and that's the end of it. And if Mark Weber says no, then nothing happens. And that's been going on ever since the, I don't know when, but I figure ever since he took over. I've heard it then in the subsequent years by many people. Ted O'Keefe, who has had the editorship and constantly had to put up with interference by Mark Weber in this regard, and finally gave up, and other people too. Basically sabotaging the Journal for Historical Review into a position where nobody would want to write for it anymore because you couldn't get a paper in for a number of reasons that I just tried to outline. So that was my first experience with them on that level. The next level was when I finally in 2000 had come to America and had published the Dissecting, the first edition, because the JHR, they were interested in proofing it, but they weren't really interested in publishing it for whatever reason, so I did it myself at my own expenses, since I was a publisher by then. And, of course, I wanted the book to be carried by the Institute for Historical Review, because it was then the most up-to-date, cutting-edge revisionist book that was to exist. And at the conference in 2000, I think in August or something, they had a conference. I met them there, had the book with me, and said, here is it. Would you be interested in taking it bulk quantities to a wholesale price? And it was Greg Raven back then, supported by Mark Weber, said, yeah, we'll take it if you give us 80% discount. Now, you need to know that normal market discounts for wholesale conditions are 50%. Cutting down to 80% when we're talking about such a big a book pretty much means that I'm stuck with the production costs and don't get anything out of it. I would basically sell it at cost. And I was really upset about that. And I think we finally came to an agreement and got a better condition. Did get 60% or something. I can't remember anymore what the exact conditions were. But that was a cutting throat approach to trying to get hold of the book. You know, that shocked me. The next development, the series now has 25 books out. And over the years, I have offered to Mark Weber the books at any conditions that he liked. I think the IHR is still viewed as one of the central outlets, the most important outlets of revisionism, whether that's true or not. The perception out there is that it is. And as a matter of fact, there isn't much else, if you disregard the Cardo Empire for a moment. But anyway, it's still there. It should carry the series. It should have carried it when it started and put on all the other books. Now, if you go to the website and find out what of the 20, how many of the 25 books they actually stock and sell, you'll come up with a list of, I don't know anymore, off the top of my head, 4, 5, 6, 7 titles, something like that they carry, and the rest they don't. Maybe by now they are down, because I know what the sales are and they never buy, so they must run out at some point. I put them under pressure, under moral pressure, with support by other people when I, first time around, I was in this country in the early 2000s to stock them. You need to sell them. I said, okay, we can make an agreement. If you don't have the, Mark Weber said, he doesn't have the money to stock large amounts. Then I said, well, stock small amounts then and reorder as you need. No, we don't have shelf space for other titles. Jeez. The next excuse. And then I said, well, okay, then let's just make it on commission, so you have to pay me only if you sell, and let me do the actual shipping. So I keep all the stock, you take orders from your customers, send me the orders, and I fulfill it, you get the money, and you pay me whenever you get the money, a cut of it. So he has no stocking issues, no. Right. The only thing he has to do is get the orders and do customer service, and that's all. Mm-hmm. He turned me down. No, he can't do it, he won't do it. That point was the point where I said he's sabotaging it. I don't know for what reasons, and I'm not interested in what the reasons are. Some say he's a spy, he's a mole, he's just interested in his own sinecure, he wants to have his retirement, he doesn't want competition, whatever.
Mark,
the reasons are, the facts are clear.
Fritz wants to say something about that, Guillermo.
If I interrupt for a moment, it became very clear to me after a few years of a friendly relationship with him, that Mark Weber, and that now we're talking like 1983, 1984, 1985, Mark Weber is a dyed-in-the-wool Holocaust believer. And he was throughout this whole period. He thinks people like you and me and me and other revisionists are basically just plain wrong, that the Jews definitely were killed in gas chambers. It might not have been as terrible as they claim, but it was terrible enough, blah, blah, blah. And he hasn't changed one iota in his thinking or even in his reasons for believing that. It was already years ago that he was talking about the diary of Goebbels as a major source of proof that the Holocaust happened, that some sort of extermination program was in
place. Where did that come from? When did it start? I can tell you that because Goebbels' thing started – sorry?
I think it started already in the 1980s. And when I could talk to him privately, it was obvious he didn't believe in – the revisionist position at all. Again and again, he made it clear. And when I would tell people that he's really not a Holocaust revisionist, they would look at me like I was some sort of a saboteur or infiltrator. That was the insanity of dealing with many of the people at the IHR. They worshiped Mark Weber. They thought the world of this guy. And one of the guys who thought of the world of him was Willis Cardo. And Mark Weber had a wonderful living arrangement for about 10 years through the 1980s. He was supported by a rich guy in Nebraska who provided food and housing and free telephone usage for about 10 years. And when the guy died, then Mark Weber went to the IHR trying to find another source of income. But for those 10 years, he totally fooled this individual, a good, decent guy, Bill Curry, who I knew personally and visited many times. But Bill Curry was unfortunately very naive about Weber. He didn't want to believe that Weber was the kind of chameleon that he truly is. I hope you know what the word chameleon is. He changes his color and spots.
Well, yeah, I don't know. But the one key experience that I had was meeting I had with him, and I think that was in 2002 or 2003. It was the time when David Irving had one of his multi-volume books, one of the volumes published. I can't remember, Hitler's War or whatever it was, Volume 2, or Churchill's War, Volume 2, Volume 3, something like that. And I was there for whatever reason, just making a presentation. I went out to eat and was together with Mark Weber and David Irving. And now, some of us may know David Irving on a personal level. I don't want to go into details here, but there are some issues here which make it a little bit difficult at times to deal with him as a person. And what I've experienced there is that Mark Weber was sitting there next to David Irving, and Mark Weber was worshiping David Irving.
Absolutely.
He behaved like a poodle. Now, if you are a normal human being with a normal self-consciousness and a normal self-respect, you would keep a personal distance to David Irving because he has personality issues which make it sometimes unpleasant to be around. But Mark Weber was the proverbial sycophant. And it was disgusting to see how it was creeping up David Irving's, excuse my French.
Right. I agree.
And that's when I saw, oh my God, what's going on here? And if you look at what Weber is saying and what David Irving has been saying about the big H, now David Irving is flip-flopping. He's not an expert at the topic at all. And he's using it for political and self-aggrandizing reasons and whatever. And Mark Weber is just sailing right in the wake of his worship David Irving. That's my opinion about it.
It's a kind of love affair. And yeah. I don't know whether it's a sexual thing or not, but it's like
we'll go there.
Well, I think we should go there because...
No, come on.
There is something...
Well, let's first give his opinion.
Irving is a very handsome man, a very charismatic man, a great public speaker. I envy him and so forth. And there are people who literally worship this guy. They are in love with him. And I think
you can be so at a distance, but you need to keep that distance. If you get too close, you'll find out otherwise.
Well, this is something very strange. I have no reason to believe there was ever anything sexual between these two guys, but I think Irving knows that that kind of attraction is there, and he has used his attractiveness in that regard, not only with Weber, but with other people as well. And it's just one of these screwy realities of this movement. Irving and Weber are what I consider to be techno-idiots. Anything that's a little bit technical is really beyond their capacity to comprehend. And they don't like to lose some kind of control. Whenever technical articles from me were submitted to the IHR with Weber involved, Weber would make all kinds of excuses for why it couldn't be published. It would be take too long and blah, blah, blah. The same kind of excuses that he made with regard to you, Garamar, about technical articles. He is a total non-technical person. He is what I call a techno-idiot. And I don't think David Irving is any better. There are people who have a great memory who can recite passages from countless books that they've read, and they can be very entertaining. They're nice to listen to. They can talk about Hitler's medical problems and whatever, and provide great entertainment. But as far as understanding simple things like the difference between a diesel engine or a gasoline engine, forget it. They're not interested. They don't even think these things might possibly be important. And the reason they don't think they're important is because they're not discussed in any of the great history books about World War II or the 20th century or National Socialism. Let me give one example, if I may. In 1984, they published my first essay, Diesel Gas Chambers, The Myth Within a Myth. And the editor or the director of the Institute at that time was Keith Steinle. He was a very nice person. My submitted text went to press, but just the day before it went to press, Steinle deleted and changed critical passages about the number of producer gas vehicles. I had talked about there being more than 100,000 carbon monoxide gas generating vehicles on the roads and highways of the Third Reich. And they changed it to several thousand. And the reason Steinle gave was that Mark Weber had read this from my text and was absolutely convinced that I must be wrong. He had never heard about this technology. Therefore, it could not possibly have been very important. Certainly no more than a few thousand of such vehicles could possibly have ever existed. Well, he was completely wrong. He had no capacity to even imagine that there really was that kind of a technology anywhere in the world. It was totally beyond him. And David Irving isn't any better. And this is an enormous problem with people like that.
There's a difference, though, between the two. Even though David Irving may be a techno idiot, as you express it, even though it's not a flattering way of putting it, he still has respect for people who do have knowledge, and he actually acknowledged the value of it. I mean, his entire involvement in the Zindel tribe, the second one, acknowledging that Leuchter and his report have an enormous, or should have an enormous impact, that this is what it kind of turned him around in a certain way for a certain time, shows that he has some respect for technical things. I've never seen that from Weber.
Right. You'll never see it forever. And I'll agree with you that Irving has probably much more of a grasp and appreciation for the technical issues. Dana wants to say
something.
I wanted to jump in, and I wanted to just say there's something you have to know about me before I even go on here and relay anything in defense of Mark Weber. once I personally came to the conclusion that the quote-unquote Holocaust, as it is presented, you know, is largely untrue, okay, I personally ceased to lose interest in the subject, and any guilt that I might have had turned to anger. And, you know, that's when I didn't continue to dive into the discipline. Now, I realized the passion people have to reverse the vilification of the German people and the way that they've been presented as monsters when in reality they were really babies. That's kind of how I look at it if you compare them to the communists and the Russians. But now on the issue of Mark usurping the IHR, you know, he says that he signed on as an associate editor and he was asked to be the president and that he did not take over. And he testified in the Zundel trial for 5 days in 1988. And at that time, with the issue of the Goebbels diary from March of 1942, he expressed skepticism at that time. But since then, I guess he has changed his opinion. He feels that now they are corroborated in Russian archives, and he feels that they are accepted now as authentic by historians. Now, I'm not going to get into the technical details of all of this, but my question is, you know, when the Journal of Historical Review was out, it was kind of the only game in town at that time. This is the pre-internet days of, you know, actual hard copy publications. But I don't know why there's all this focus and scrutiny on the IHR, because you really don't need the IHR to get the message out to the people now that you have the internet. And, you know, I mean, it just feels like... why is it all resting on just this one organization? You know, I feel like there should be multiple Holocaust revisionist organizations.
That's a good question. Can either of you address?
Well, I'll try to answer it. I agree with Dana. Today, the ball game is totally changed because of technology. I have my website. I was able with my website to put my message out there and reach a few people, and it's still there for anybody who's interested. Other people are doing the same thing with very difficult messages, and one of the things a new IHR might do is to help budding revisionists get on the internet with websites or YouTube videos and things like that. There are some people who have good experience and are very skilled at those new technologies, and it would be great to use some sort of an organization to help teach revisionists how to distribute.
Well, that's what the Institute was supposed to do, Fritz. Yeah, and I don't think this idea of scattering around is nearly as effective as having one place where there's a center of this research and focus and knowledge and so on going on. And that's where new revisionists could be given jobs and their work published and could be, you know, mixing with the older revisionists and so on. And I always focus on this idea of an institute. I think, Guillermo, you know, in Europe, they have a lot of institutes of history, and they're not just one person sitting there, you know, putting out a little newsletter or something. I mean, it's real work going on, and this is what it takes to do in real serious intellectual work.
Well,
absolutely.
I agree to a certain extent, but there are always very difficult problems. The moment you have a building or an office space, you can become a target for troublemakers and infiltrators and people who just want to cause havoc.
Well,
so
the left has got bombs. They did.
But you know, that's always like the lone wolf versus political parties or something. I mean, probably a philosophical discussion. You want to come in on this, Guillermo, and say what you think?
Well, yeah, I mentioned it earlier that Arthur Butz has always said, I stay out of it, and you should too, because why kick a dead horse? We need to get beyond the IHR, and we need to create something new. If we want something that works in a certain way, and we can't make the IHR work that way. Mark Weber is hogging it for whatever reason. He's very efficient at it. And I must say, I've contact to the people on the board, and some call them just stooges or figureheads or whatever. I don't think they are. I have fairly decent relationships with some of them, and I know that they are in a bad position. For them, is okay. The question for them is, what do we do? Okay, Mark Weber is not doing the job as we would prefer to see it, but who else could we put in there who would be doing a better job?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a Gemma, if you would apply, we would take you, and say, I'm sorry, I can't.
Well,
for me, yeah, that's the situation. I have my family, I have three little kids, I'm a stay-at-home dad with three little kids, 3, 6, 8 years old. You can't run an operation like that. Forget it. And that's the end of that. And who else is there?
I don't know. That's what we need to talk about.
I do know. I do know. There is nobody. That's that simple.
Well, let me say one thing. Mark Weber is in it for the money. He doesn't have any other source of income. He's not going to get a job working for the government or anywhere else. But as long as he's at the IHR and is the figurehead of that place and pretending to be the great historian, he gets contributions. He gets money in his pocket, and it pays his bills and maybe even makes him comfortable at times. So that's what's really it.
I would say if people don't like the IHR, that don't send them money. I mean, nobody's forcing anybody.
Well, I certainly don't send them money, but there's a lot of people who think that they're doing a good job and not realizing what it should be.
They have some bucks to spend, some bucks to donate. They want to give it to some entity that does some good work in their eyes. And what's out there? What alternative is there? You know, you can give it to...
What's inexcusable on Mark Weber's part is for him to go around and undermine Holocaust revisions by saying, oh, yes, the Holocaust happened. 2 million Jews or whatever were killed in gas chambers. It was terrible. The Nazis were blah, blah, bad, blah, blah, blah. That kind of stuff. That's really inexcusable as far as I'm concerned. But that's what Mark Weber's all about. He's trying to hold on to the tax-exempt status, which would be at some risk if he were a real revisionist. And he's getting by. He's got a nice, cozy existence. He doesn't work hard there. You know, he hangs around there a few hours every day as he feels, and goes home when he feels like, and that's it. He makes phone calls to people all around the world, has a good time, basically.
I think you guys are putting all your eggs in one basket, and you shouldn't do that, because, you know, that's why you're disappointed in the outcome here.
No, well, there are other organizations. There's CODO, and there is
is there? What is CODO?
I'm surprised you said that, Kramer.
Yes, because I have the interview, and I'm saying no. The Bradley Smith is in his mid 80s and has fought off cancer 3 times, have had 1 stroke just a year and a half ago, and there is not all that much more to it. There are a few volunteers who can spend a few hours here and there, but you can't really pull off big things with that kind of a structure. If Bradley Smith, who is doing his newsletter, and he is the only one who has been doing a newsletter since the early 90s consecutively and constantly up to today, if that drops out, what then? You can't build upon an 85-year-old man like this.
Well, again, they've got a website, and that's what it is. You know, there's a website with lots of information on it. And then there's that journal, the Inconvenient Journal, Inconvenient History Journal.
I think that, you know, regardless of Mark Weber, no matter who is the director, you know, of the IHR, it's not going to change the advance of revisionism, because as long as the Jews are in power, you know, you're not going to be able to outcompete the media and the Hollywood industry and all of these movies and the educational system. I mean, it's the amount of people you can reach with the internet is about the best shot that you have. And you know, I mean, it's the money that...
But there has to be some brains behind it. I think an organization that has a plan, which this doesn't, and that has a purpose, understand what it's about, then, you know, it goes about things in a certain way. And if you got a good organization going at the IHR, you could make a lot of headway against this big Zionist power. But I understand what it is. But it's all kind of a defeatist attitude, if you ask me. That there's, that if we just get around, everybody get on the internet and make some noise, that's gonna accomplish it.
Well, I hate being a defeatist. I mean, I'm not a defeatist. I just feel like, you know, that there's a threshold beyond which, you know, you just can't overpower the organization that our adversaries have right now, and, you know, and this little organization. I mean, what is the size of
the IHR? But it's the same thing, Dana. You think that you're gonna start an imperium. And that's the same thing. You're going to start an imperium somehow.
Well, I don't. I mean, that's a general goal this, and a vision for the future. I don't think I'm going to start anything. I mean, I'm just one guy, you know.
What are you doing, Fritz?
What's that?
What's Fritz doing? He's messing around with his headphones.
Well, yeah, they're two different things.
The money that's sent to the IHR is a matter of public record. And, you know, when people send money to, say, someone like David Duke or Paul Grubach or whoever it might be, you know, and I'm not putting them in the same category. I'm just shooting out names. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that money isn't accountable to anything. At least you can look up the public record.
Dana, if people want to take it off their income tax, then it has to be done then he has to claim it. But if there are people,
right.
We got 30 seconds, but if people want to just, you know, hand him some money and say, hey, this is okay, and he probably gets money that way. You know, ladies, gentlemen, we are going to our break. We're going to have a 5-minute break. We have a musical interlude here, and we'll be back in 5 minutes. So hold on and don't hang up. Whatever you do, and take a little break, and be sure you try to get back here in 5 minutes, okay?
All right.
All right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on December 16th, 2013. And I have three special guests today, and they are Friedrich Paul Berg, otherwise known as Fritz Berg, Germar Rudolph, and Dana Rocapriori. I'm going to get a little bit in here for myself at the beginning of the second hour here. And I think somebody was trying to call during the break, and I want to tell people, listeners, to hold off for a while because we've still got some things we need to cover before I would be ready to take any calls. So I think that Fritz has made it clear and that Mark Weber is not a Holocaust revisionist in the way that we think about it. And so that's why, yet he is a chameleon, and he likes to fit in. I've said this myself, he likes to fit in where with the people he's around, and he's good at, you know, pretending he thinks like they do. And so he was playing this role for quite a long time, and as soon as he didn't have to do that, he switched the IHR to what he preferred it to be all about. And then Germar has made it clear that that there isn't anybody to put in his place, and while I think Germar thinks that we need something like this, we don't have anybody, and we don't know how to get rid of Mark Weber. I just want to then say that I'm looking at the IHR website. They have audio pages, you know, and it's made up entirely of Mark Weber podcasts. And he's really done a lot of them, mostly guest appearances going way back on various radio programs. So, I mean, considering the time, it's not that many, but there's about 8 pages of them, and they're all by him. And at the end there's some from conferences of other people. You know, there's some speakers at conferences that were recorded. But otherwise, so it's like I think he's made the IHR into like the Mark Weber Show or, markweber.com. And that's what he wants to do. He's got a much bigger ego than I ever dreamed because he seems to be such a mild person. So who's trying?
Well, it's either the Mark Weber Show or the David Irving Show. I mean, any chance he can get to promote David Irving, he'll do that as well.
Now, if I may chip in here a few thoughts. Okay. We've been talking for an hour now about Mark Weber, and I'd like to get beyond that because we have had Mark Weber as a topic that revisionists struggled with for the past 20 years, fading out of view more and more as the years went by. And now this thing comes up suddenly, and this discussion we're having now makes it look bigger than it deserves to be. And there is a danger that we give him now a significance with our discussion that he would otherwise not have. And I think he doesn't even deserve. If we talk about that, he is sucking up funds that could be available otherwise to more effective use. That's one thing. The other thing we should really focus on now is, okay, there is no way of getting rid of him. Why should we let him just keep digging his own grave? What we really need, if we need something that works, if we need something that works better, we need to create it. And we need to get beyond this. And if you don't like, bickering and bitching is not going to help anyone. If you don't like what's going on, don't complain. Do a better job.
Exactly.
You know, and if I were in a position that I could, with my time resources and so on, could do it, I would probably do it. I mean, I was willing to do it back when I was, my legal situation was always in jeopardy, and at the end I was deported. Of course, nobody would take me then because they knew my legal situation is very fickle. Now it no longer is, but I'm in a family situation now where it doesn't work. So anyway, we should look out. We should build up people. I mean, there are young people up there that have the potential in the future as they grow and learn to become new leaders that could grow into what we're looking for. And that's what we need to focus on. And if that tax-exempt organization doesn't work anymore, there's nothing holding us back creating something new. And that's what we should focus on.
Well, that's what a lot of people say, but you say we. Who's weak? Because everybody's overtaxed in their time schedule. And also people like Fritz says, well, he's kind of slowing down, he's kind of retiring a little bit. You know, I mean, this is where, name some people. I mean, name how we would do this.
Well, there are things going on in the background, and it's very slow going because, revisionism is a strange movement. You know, I've got the impression that a lot of people in there don't want it to succeed because if we succeeded now, we would lose our jobs. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, it's not my job. I'm not earning my living with it. Mark Weber does. Some other people out there do. And as soon as the mainstream historian would kick in with their resources, with their capabilities of doing things, they would outcompete us in a second and we would be gone. Do these people want that? That actually depend on it? I mean, the question isn't really realistic because it's not going to happen anytime soon unless there is a shift in paradigms worldwide. And it's not going to happen anytime soon. And it's most certainly not under our control.
Well, but if I may jump in here a little bit, the IHR took a long time to build. I care about what happened to the IHR because I invested a lot of time and energy. I helped raise at least $600,000 or $700,000 for the IHR. That was hard work. I fought a legal battle for 2 years with just one particular estate, which finally dropped a big chunk of money to the IHR in 2002. So I have a big investment in time and energy in making the IHR what it was at its best. It's not so easy for me to just throw that out the window. And when we try to make some other organization comparable to what the IHR was or was going to be, we're going to find that it's a lot of hard work as well. I like the idea of the internet. This is a fantastic alternative approach to spreading the revisionist message. But we're spread all over the world today, and it's very hard to share our skills and promote our work the way it really should be with videos and whatnot and websites and so forth. But that's really where we should be focused. And I think we can succeed with that rather than try to build some little alternative institute to the IHR. So I think we're all in somewhat agreement about this. It's nice to have a meeting place, but you can have conferences at almost any major hotel in the world. You know, you make a reservation for a nice 3-day weekend, invite revisionists from wherever to that particular place, get together, have speeches. You don't need a brick and mortar place as such.
Agreed.
But what I think is valuable, I feel like you, I feel there's an investment there. And it's not to just say, oh, let that go, start something else. It's not easy to do at all. And it's the name, the Institute for Historical Review, that so many people are familiar with. It's the past of it. It's all those archives and so on.
The archives are on the internet today. They're available through other sources. Everything that was ever published by the IHR is available online to anyone in the world. Okay?
Exactly.
You don't have to go to San Diego or wherever to actually sit there and look at this stuff. So the world has changed and we should adapt. I think we're all more or less in agreement on that. And if we have conferences once in a while, I think that would be the social part of our internet organization.
Somebody needs to organize these conferences.
That's true.
Somebody who almost has it as a full-time job because nobody can take this stuff on, you know.
Well, may be. We should, for one thing, build up a good mailing list, an email list of people who are genuine revisionists or genuine revisionist supporters, and work on that mailing list. It'll be primarily with internet addresses and things like that. That's enormously important, far more important than having an office in some particular location.
No, it's not the office, because that's not that much.
Well, okay.
Office.
All right. Well, we agree then.
I mean, I just think that a lot of the frustration here is misdirected towards Mark Weber and is really at the objective.
No, you're wrong, Dana. It's not misdirected at Mark Weber. Mark Weber is responsible for all of this. You don't seem to be getting that.
Well, I think that you're giving him way too much credit. I think you act like
he's
not much more.
Credit.
It's not whether he's influential, it's what
he's done to the IHR and taking it over.
And what he's done to revisionism by going to Iran, for example, and basically telling the people there that the Holocaust is true, that the Holocaust revisionists are basically completely wrong. And after a few months after he goes to Iran, suddenly the whole Iranian government embraces the Holocaust hoax. It's just maybe a coincidence, but that's what happened. And I don't think it's just a coincidence. When you have someone like Mark Weber stabbing us in the back, it hurts. And we should get angry about it. And, you know, even if we can't do anything about it, I think it's perfectly appropriate to talk about it. This guy is an absolute scoundrel, and he's not alone. There are other people out there like that. And we might as well, you know, recognize what these people are, that they're out there.
Well, then the board of directors on the IHR, who Guillermo Rudolph is in good terms with, I mean, if he's doing such a bad job, you know, it seems like all this criticism is external. I mean,
Guillermo. What I didn't know that these – I was under the impression that these directors were just – we're just not even involved at all, but you say that's not true.
Well, legally speaking, they can kick him out.
I mean, do they have a desire to do so? I mean,
I can't speak for all of them. I can't speak for them what's going on now. Mm-hmm. The last time I had contact with one of them, is the most active and outspoken is, that's my impression at least, is 2 or 3 years ago or so, I can't remember exactly. And the situation was then that they say, well, yeah, we know that it's not working well, but what's the alternative? Give us somebody else, some name that can take over, that does a better job, that wants to do the job, and we'll discuss it.
I think that's our real problem.
That's the same kind of excuse that Bill Curry, this wealthy guy in Nebraska, gave for continuing to support Mark Weber. Instead of just kicking Mark Weber out the door, which is what he should have done, he said, well, I've invested 5 or 6 years in him already. I might as well keep investing a few more. And it's very, very lazy thinking. One thing I've learned is that in Germany and in Europe, there are real high-quality revisionists. And you can see the difference in the German revisionist forum on CODO, on the CODO discussion forum, as compared to the English-speaking discussion forum there. The Germans are very, very good. The other Europeans are also excellent. They're not all from Germany at all. But here in America, where we have real freedom of speech, nobody's going to be thrown in jail, the people are basically very, very cowardly. They're very easily intimidated by the suggestion that they might lose their job and so forth. It's a really sad, horrible situation. The Jews have achieved an enormous victory, and this may ultimately have consequences for centuries to come by criminalizing revisionism. That's what they've done in Europe. They throw people in jail for expressing revisionist ideas and thoughts about the Jews. It's an enormous victory that they have, and that may be where we should focus our energy, to undermine and change that kind of terror that they impose on so many good people. I am very sympathetic to Germans and Germany and so forth, but there are limits to my sympathy. When they go along with this kind of mind control from the government or from Jews or from anywhere, they really should be ashamed of themselves. But they go along with it because it's the easy way out.
Yeah.
And somehow we should deal with that as much as anything, certainly far more than we deal with Mark Weber.
Okay, Fritz, let me get this in here. There are bigger
issues at stake here.
Well, this is where I'd like to go, Dana, right now, and you can comment on this. I think we need to talk about the importance of Holocaust revisionism to solving the world problems that we see in this new world order and so on, global government and so on. Because people like Dana and those who think like him will say, well, this is not going to make any difference. What we need to do is attack this this order that we're under and this criminalization of things. And but, you know, in my opinion, I think in Fritz's, the Holocaust is the underpinning, is one of the main underpinnings of this. And a lot of people want to deny that now. And they say, oh, no, you know, and nothing, there's nothing that much to do there.
Right.
People already know, blah, blah. But
no,
I think,
Carolyn, I don't take me the wrong way. I know all of the consequences that have come as a result of the perpetuation of this myth. I mean, it goes from everything from the denial of race to open immigration to, you know, the idea that any kind of nationalism is evil and is going to lead to another genocide. I mean, it's just the ramifications are huge. And that's why I realize why you're so passionate about the subject. But what I would argue here is that many Americans today, and this might sound contradictory because I said before that, you know, the Jews have such a powerful influence over the minds of the masses with the media, but I'm finding that Americans are emotionally and psychologically removed from the Holocaust. It doesn't have the same powerful effect it had in the past. I mean, we're talking, you know, a long time now. I mean, it's, you know,
Dana,
and
it's
a lot
in the
of,
news
of,
all the time.
What?
You know, and it's in the news all the time.
Well,
and
that's
and
they
it's
want
used.
To keep it, they want
well,
to keep
sure,
it alive.
That's right.
But you
and
want,
that's what.
Yeah.
But you think that people aren't paying any attention to that, though, huh?
I think, Carolyn, what I'm going to do for you as a personal a way to actually demonstrate this, I'm going to go out in the public and interview people, random strangers, and just ask them, I don't know, maybe we could formulate the questions together just to see how they respond. I mean, you see these Jay Leno things where Americans can't even answer basic questions about where is the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean. You know, I mean, so it's...
Well, that's the dumbing down, and that's all part of this New World Order, global government stuff, and that's again, comes back to how they got that power, and the Holocaust is one of the pillars upon which they hang on to that.
Right, but I'm just
Kimar,
saying that...
would you come in on this, please, and say, you know, how...
Well,
you,
there's a big way. Difference, there's a big difference between the... American, the United States populace and the German people, if I may make the difference. The German people know full well what repercussions it has because it's choking them constantly and everybody knows it there or they feel it instinctively. So that's also the reason why, in spite of all the repression you have in Germany, get more people involved on a sometimes anonymous way, but more interest and more thorough thinking about it. And for Americans, it's an intellectually self-sufficient nation. Let's say it that way. You know, their horizon goes from ocean to ocean, but not beyond. And, it is true, unless you are an intellectual and you have somewhat historical and political, education that enables you to connect the dots, people will not even after some prodding, grasp the importance of it. And it needs education. So I realize that for American, for Anglo-Saxon audiences, at least at this side of the Atlantic, doing revisionism is something that you're doing for elites, intellectual elites, which are important if there is a paradigm shift to come to prepare them or give them things that they can hold on to or pick up. So it has to be there. But for the masses in this country, I'm right now rather pessimistic, too. That's different in Europe again. Europe is much more aware because it's very close to their history, not just Germany. Germany, in particular, Austria, but also France, with all the trouble they have with their occupation history and so forth.
Right.
So you have to make you have to distinguish between this side and that side of the Atlantic.
But, Germar, wouldn't you agree that all this repression is going to backfire on them ultimately at some point? I mean, aren't the Germans can't like the situation they're in where they have to flagellate themselves constantly and with this guilt trip and give, you know, their, you know, billions of dollars to Israel and, submarines and, you know, nuclear powered submarines and endless. It's endless, you know, that you can get arrested for just, bringing this material up. So this has got to create a backlash there. And, you know, as far as the dumbing down over here goes, the point I was making is that dumbing down process is backfiring on them as well, because even their own lies are not being remembered. You know, in all this Jewish entertainment culture we have, most people don't really, I mean, they've seen Schindler's List or whatever movie is out for the week that they're coming out with, you know, but for the most part, I don't think Americans really care about the so-called suffering of Jews in World War II, and a lot of them are starting to wake up to the domination that is happening all around the Western world. So I do see signs, positive signs of hope, and you know, we have to just find a way to manipulate them and exploit them to our advantage.
Garamard, do you think there's a backlash? Are there going to be a backlash? Is the backlash building?
In Europe, most certainly there is. I mean, they have the repression in order to keep the lid on the pot, you know, else it would blow up. And the higher the pressure, the more the repression, and it's a vicious circle, and at some point it's bound to explode. The Germans have to keep things under control also because there's so much foreign pressure onto Germany to keep it under control. Because, of course, the Germans would be the first one to embrace revisionism. And here in America, I think, we have to distinguish between what people realize and what they feel. Revisionism addresses the intellectual mind, addresses the upper layers of the brain, whereas Jewish propaganda, to say in a sweeping term, addresses emotions, addresses the limbic system, our lower brain functions.
Right.
And people react with Pavlovian reflexes to certain things in the way they have been conditioned by this constant onslaught of propaganda. And therefore, it is important that something be done about it.
Well, that's why I feel all this technicality about arcane points of crematorial one or two, you know, this isn't what is going to do the job that needs to be done here. We need
not for the masses. That's right. Yeah. Not for the masses. But of course, emotionalizing that thing is something that can be done, and that I morally and well, I don't know. By
yeah,
my
I mean,
personality,
I don't like that argument that people aren't interested in crematory one or two. No, they're not, but that's not all that we're talking about, you know. It doesn't
well,
have
I'm
to
just
be
saying
that
in general that
yeah.
the Jews... Go ahead.
I just took a phone call. I thought I'd better let this person call. So who is on the line, please, and give us your name and where you're from.
Oh, yes. Carol, this is Jim Hoppegard from Tennessee.
Okay,
and,
Jim. Welcome.
Yeah. Could you tell me, I have heard that... I think this Paulson speech by Himmler, where he talks about exterminating the Jews, is that authentic, or was this faked by the Allies after the war?
Well, let's ask both Germar and Fritz about that.
Well, I've listened to the actual speech. It's a lengthy speech, and it's actually a brilliant speech by Heinrich Himmler. But one has to recognize that as many good speakers do, they use a great deal of hyperbole and sarcasm. Heinrich Himmler, and this is a genuine speech, I have no great dispute or reason to doubt the content of the text of the speech as it's given to us. But one has to realize Heinrich Himmler was talking to a audience of SS people. He was trying to give them a kind of pep talk. He was trying to build up their commitment to the cause. And among the things he talked about was the fact that the bombing of Germany actually had some good effects, because it was finally getting people out of the cities and into the healthier countryside to live a much more natural life. Now, does anyone really believe Heinrich Himmler was happy about the bombing of German cities, the destruction of beautiful structures that had taken 1,000 years to build in many cases? Of course not. But he's talking, as any number of good public speakers do, with a certain amount of sarcasm and hyperbole. And that's what this talk about the Vernichtung der Juden was all about. It wanted to get rid of these people, no doubt about it, but that does not mean physical extermination at all, okay? And that's what has to be recognized. I think the speech is basically genuine, if that's what you want as an answer.
But he didn't mean literally that they were going to exterminate Jews. In other words, there was no none of the leaders of the Third Reich actually said that they were going to actually physically exterminate the Jews.
Well,
Hitler
said if the Jews succeed in bringing Europe into a Second World War, then it will be the end of their presence in Europe. Now, I mean, you can take that any
Hitler,
way you
Hitler
want.
That was Hitler who said that in 1939 in his February speech. And was it January? Okay, but it was the response to the
letter. But it didn't mean extermination then either. It just meant, you know, we'll win and the Jews will lose out, you know.
Right.
We're not going to let them take over.
Physically, Jews could still be alive, but you wouldn't have this crazy religion having such a tremendous influence on the affairs of Europe as you had before.
Let's let Germar answer that question, too. Did you have anything different you wanted to add, Germar, about the Himmler speech?
Yeah, you have to see it in the context of all of Himmler's speeches, and I would even expand that to the leaders of the Third Reich, the polemics they used. And there are many instances where they used words like Vernichtung, Ausrottung, and similar, which means extermination, extirpation. But where it's clear from the context that they could possibly not have meant physically killing the people in masses. So polemics in the Second World War, even running up to the Second World War, the revolution at a time of National Socialism was a radical group. They had a lot of bloody polemics because that's the way the times that were formed, the circumstances where they grew up in these leaders, and they continued that kind of polemics into the war.
Go ahead.
What a leader says is one thing. Politicians are prone to exaggerate, to make polemics, to lie. What we really need is, okay, you claim that you are going to go out and kill people. The question is, have you done it? How have you done it? Where are the corpses? So we're down to the nitty gritty at the end after all. So it's not going to help us to quote leaders of the Third Reich. But you can find a lot of quotes by leaders of the Western allies that are pretty bloody and can look into the details and find out, yeah, they did it. But
leaders have done this throughout all history. I mean, and that's why, you know, it's hard to tell the difference between propaganda or boasting and an actual real event that occurred.
Yeah, and also a lot of it is simply mistranslating foreign words, in this case German, even knowing that they're doing it maybe, but, you know, saying, oh, this means this, and convincing people because they have the media control to keep repeating that.
Robert Forreston put it very eloquently by saying this was warrior talk on the part of Himmler. Warrior talk. You know, you want to be the tough guy and you want to inspire all the other guys to be just as tough as you are. So you say, well, we're going to destroy those bastards. Well, or destroy the communists. Doesn't mean they're going to go out and kill every communist who ever lived.
Every good sport coach says that about the opposing team, too.
Right, exactly.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
And, of course, the Americans and the British used all kinds of terrible talk, especially the Americans, maybe.
And nobody holds
them accountable for that kind of language.
George Patton did the same thing. George Patton especially, and Eisenhower as well.
Yes. What, Jim?
Carol, Mark Weber, he was on Kyle's show just about an hour ago, and he said that there was three camps in Poland where they had homicidal gas chambers. Is that true?
No.
Well, of course it's not, but, you know, Weber's saying
Look, Weber is a coward as well. I challenged him to debate me, and he turned me down, okay? Let him debate me on precisely that subject of those alleged gas chambers in Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor. I'll wipe the floor with this guy because he's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Wait a minute, let me finish. Let him try to explain what kind of gas chambers did they have in those places. Were they diesel gas chambers? Were they Zyklon B gas chambers? Were they gasoline engine gas chambers? What were they? Give some specific information. Now,
Weber, if you prove there were no gas chambers, they're still going to say that, you know, the Germans still put them into camps and the conditions led to them dying of typhus.
But,
you know,
Dana,
so,
come on. Yeah. Mark Weber is actually saying that he believes there were gas chambers in those camps. And this is
you know, for me,
much, yeah,
for me, it comes down to credibility and authority. Both are linked to what has he published on any of these camps that can be considered serious research, serious publishing. Weber is a historian. He has published quite a few papers, but on these camps, he hasn't published anything. And if he runs around making claims like that, that sounds to me like an echo of what David Irving has been saying over the years. And he has a track record of zero about publishing on these subjects or even researching as well. Neither of them have.
Gerber admits he's following David Irving in this.
Yeah. So, if you ask a revisionist what is the truth here, I said, well, make up your own mind. Go to the Holocaust Handbooks website and read the four books that we have on these camps. That is three books for each and every one of them. And one book, most recently published, that covers the whole topic and has 1,500 pages. And there are the answers, all the answers that we think can be given. And unless Mark Weber has done anything similar, deep and wide, there's no point in discussing it. Everybody can stand up and have an opinion.
How can you prove or disprove, you know, an allegation where you can't go back in time and examine the physical material evidence? I mean,
you can.
Wait.
You can.
Yeah.
How do you do it? I mean, if you wanted to do it.
Let me try, please. Let me try, please. Look, the claims regarding Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor are based entirely on so-called eyewitness testimony. Now, when you look at that testimony, which is all that you really have as far as those places are concerned, you find the most absurd kind of impossible claims. For example, the corpses were supposedly blue.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Now that's just plain stupid. The man who made that statement was a liar, Kurt Gerstein.
And Michael Hoffman did a great job in his Tales of the Holohogs showing all these particular examples.
That it is not true that we have only eyewitness accounts, because for all these camps there have been excavations recently over the past 10, 15 years, and the results of these excavations are pretty revealing. In the latest book, the 1,500-page book, they are summarized and revised critically, and also in the other books, all the monographs have chapters on it. So there's more. You can go back in time. With forensic archaeology, you can do an awful lot. There has been quite a lot of work been done on it, and even though they try to the mainstream researchers who have done that try to support mainstream historiography with it, the techniques, rhetoric they have to apply to actually make it work are ridiculous. And you can analyze them and find, all right, we have some points of the other side that make sense. So it is not like these camps were just transit camps where nobody died. There are mass graves, but the extent of them is most definitely not what we should find. We have to find if the claims are true. That's the physical evidence that we have.
Right, but can't they say that the bodies were just burned and, you know, you're not going to find graves because they're all up in smoke?
There's no evidence of burning either.
Yeah, then you throw out the eyewitnesses, because you have all the eyewitnesses claiming for Treblinka, for instance, that the first 700,000 were first buried and then they started excavating it. So you have set in stone with all these eyewitnesses and with historiography so far a certain claim. And if the evidence doesn't jive with the claim, then you have a problem. That's what the other side have. They have a problem.
Right. And see, now Mark Weber will not get on with anybody like anyone here on this program today. Maybe he'd get on with Dana. He's already been on with Dana. But he won't do that because he cannot answer these questions and these,
I heard that David Irving give a speech several years ago. He said there was gas vans that were used on the Eastern Front. Is there any truth to that?
Walter Ralph, right?
The gas vans were something totally different. The Germans used gas vans for ordinary transportation, and that they were gas wagons in the sense that they used poison gas as the fuel. You could
have
killed.
They didn't gas any fusion, though, right? They didn't gas any fusion, those fans, right?
No.
Why do you care so much? After everything these people have done, I mean, with the book Hellstorm by Thomas Goodrich, I got to tell you, I don't lose sleep at night over what happened, did happen, or didn't happen to these people with communism. They've got the blood of millions of people on their hands. Why should we spend all our time worrying about how they suffer?
That's the same thing. That's the same thing that. That's the same thing that Greg Johnson comes up with. You know, if we've got such a thing as Holocaust revisionism, we want to work with that. We don't want to just end up saying, "Oh heck, you know, these other people were worse, so why should we worry about what the Germans did?" Because the fact is, the Germans didn't do these things.
Well, there is a there is a huge problem, and that is there was mass extermination during World War II, but the perpetrators were the Americans. The real mass murderers in modern history were the Americans, using bombers and incineration of one sort or another to turn entire cities into crematory ovens.
Absolutely.
Not for people
That's
who were already dead. Not for people who were already dead, but for people who were still alive. The United States of America, as a matter of deliberate military strategy, committed mass murder on a scale that even exceeds probably the horrors of the so-called Holocaust. We turned entire cities into flaming hell deliberately by dropping napalm on women and children.
When Guillermar brought up the emotional brain, I think that's what needs to be done here. We need to show, you know, the women and children that were burned alive, incinerated by Allied bombs. I mean, and we don't have 100 Holocaust movies about this stuff.
No.
You know,
well,
and Americans don't care because the Germans were the bad guys, right? So that's why.
Well, that's right. And why do they think that? Because of the Holocaust. That's why the Holocaust revisionism and the Holocaust debunking is so important. It always comes back to that.
Holocaust propaganda liberates America from any responsibility for its own crimes, for its own far worse crimes.
Right, but
those
I think Americans are arrogant bastards. I mean, you know, the Japanese killed a lot of Chinese, they can say, but does that justify the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I mean, at what point, you know, we can compare a million different things.
Control of this program. I've got another caller calling in. Jim, did you have anything more that you wanted to say?
I don't like to say, Guillermar, you're a real hero. Yeah, I mean, you stood up the truth. You went to prison rather than renounce what was true. And David Irving was a coward. You know, he went waffle and he said, "Oh yeah, there were gas chambers after all." And Mark Weber is just like David Irving, a coward. All you gentlemen here, and you, Carol, you are heroes because you're standing up for the truth. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in, Jim. Jim's a pretty good hero, too, because he's always calling in and asking. He's the one that asked us that question about Mark on Dana's show that was so revealing. I mean, it's just good to have him on record for saying those things. I'll just take this call. I wanted you to say something, Guillermar, about these camps. The evidence, I mean, you know, there needs to be some evidence, and I think this should be talked about. And the thing is, he's still calling. Let me go to my Skype page.
Well, the two camps where the evidentiary situation is pretty clear, as I mentioned already, Treblinka on one end and Belzec on the other, where they already by the areas in which the graves are supposed to have been, simply don't have enough area or enough volume to put all the bodies in that supposed to have been in there. And when they made these excavations and these investigations, they basically confirmed that the graves that could have been there are most definitely not the size that would have been needed. And in Belzec, they reacted accordingly by covering over the entire area with a huge concrete area with rocks. And in Treblinka, we already have some of the area covered with that, both of which actually makes it difficult, if not impossible, for future researcher to do further research. But both of which basically has confirmed that the official story cannot be true. That doesn't necessarily mean that we revisionists with our theory are absolutely true, absolutely correct. The truth might lie somewhere in between. It's difficult to say because all that was done is some drillings and ground-penetrating radar scans, none of which are extremely conclusive with regards to the results.
But the fact is, they've had all this time, and from 1945 or 6 or something, they've been examining those camps. I mean, the Holocaust historian people. And the
and they
don't find anything. Here's this call.
Right after the war, the Polish and the Soviet institutions, authorities in Poland did some research. They did some excavations and trying to verify the claims made by eyewitnesses. And at that time, the results were even more devastating for the mainstream. So these results kind of got buried away and didn't get published and didn't get any attention because they were refuting the official claims. So they did something, and they knew why they didn't go any further, because they knew whatever they find is not going to confirm what they want.
Well, that's right. That's right. And then Mark Weber, I just want to make this point before I let welcome this new caller, that it shows the damage that he is doing by being in control of the this revisionist institution, and then going around and saying that 2 million Jews were killed, you know, and 1 million were killed in gas chambers, that there were gas chambers in these camps back there, and he, and the Goebbels diary that he talks about, and all this stuff that he does, it sabotages the work of revisionists. So it's really like, you know, from our point of view, it's evil. It's very damaging. You can't just ignore him.
Yeah, I think he hasn't done that so openly in the years before.
At all. Not at all.
Yeah. So at any rate, how do we react to that?
Yeah, well, let's say just ignore him and leave him alone. He's out there doing all kinds of damage. And Dana and all these people over there, like at Renegade Now or anywhere he goes on all kinds of programs, they think he's just great, and they listen to him. So they're being brainwashed by this stuff, by him. And he should be doing the opposite of what he's doing.
Because Mark Weber is not just some ordinary Joe Blow who happens to be a Holocaust believer. He is the head of what was, at least at one time, the great leading revisionist organization in the world. If Guillermo Rudolph would come around and say, oh, well, yes, they did gas 2 million Jews in those, that would be also devastating for the revisionist cause, because Guillermo is not some ordinary Joe Blow. He's a leading Holocaust revisionist. If he turns around all of a sudden and says, oh, yeah, I was wrong before, or I was mistaken before, I wasn't well enough informed before, that's a terrible blow, just as David Irving undermined revisionism when he came out of jail and suddenly started jabbering like a true blue Holocaust believer.
Exactly. Very well said, Fritz. Thank you. Okay, caller, are you on the line here, and would you give us your name? Hello.
Yes, I am, Carolyn. My name's Charles Steiner.
Hello, Charles. Welcome.
Thank you. I was listening to Dana's defense of Mark Weber, and I had listened just before you came on, or your program came on, to the suggested Block Talk Radio, where Mark Weber was talking, and all of Dana's points in defense of Mark Weber were the same points that Mark Weber gave on the broadcast.
Okay.
It was interesting, that, differently worded, but a couple of things that I didn't hear Dana say that Mark said, which I found interesting because provocative, was that the IHR has no position on Holocaust or any subject related to the Holocaust because it never did, and it's up to the writers who contribute to it to present their position, but IHR as an institution has no position. Mm-hmm. How could you not have a position?
Well, it used to have a position, see.
I thought so, too, but he says it doesn't. And then he said, and it will not. Officially, it does not take any position. And then he said, too, that Belzec, Treblinka, and Sobibor, Himmler sent millions to those camps, and they just disappeared.
What do you say to that, Fritz?
Well, they didn't disappear. We know today, for example, that there are still hundreds of thousands of Jewish Holocaust survivors alive all over the world. So there were huge numbers of Jewish Holocaust survivors alive at the very end of the war.
But
obviously they were not exterminated. Now,
As I mean, about Weber, the IHR.
Well, Weber is trying to talk out of both sides of his mouth. He's still trying to get revisionists to send him money. Think, you know, if they're dumb enough to believe that he is some sort of a serious revisionist in some way or other and send him money, well, that's great for Mark. He's not going to turn them down. And so he talks out of his both sides of his mouth as necessary to keep the checks coming in. It's very simple.
I've seen Mark Weber appear on a show of the English channel of the Iranian television, mm-hmm. and he was featured as an expert on some issues of Zionist influence in the United States. And I think I've seen him someplace else. Now, he is transmogrifying himself into some expert that's accepted by halfway mainstream media as an expert for this and that. And I think that's what he's trying to do, broadening his base by stepping away from an extremely controversial thing, the Holocaust, and getting his foot into the door and into other topics and other areas.
Well, I want to talk about Zionist global power. That's what he thinks we need. But, you know, that's so vague. How do you make headway against that by just saying, we're going against this Zionist globalist power?
And well, he'll even say... There's a lot of ways you can do it. I mean, you can show how the Jewish influence has gotten the United States into the wars in the last couple decades. You can show the... the money we send to Israel, you can show, and a lot of Americans are angry about, you know, our involvement in these wars and the cost, economically, the cost in blood and treasure. And, you know, I mean, that's a more effective way of fighting the Jews because, you know, the Holocaust is either firmly embedded in the consciousness of Americans through all the propagandistic movies, or Americans don't care anymore because they don't even... You know, they're in La La Land. They're listening to Beyonce and Rihanna, and, you know, it just doesn't matter. It's not even relevant to them anymore. So, you know, I think we have to really assess what is the best way to attack the enemy. Now, I agree with you on revisionism.
Is this the role of Mark Weber in the Institute for Historical Review, though?
That's how I see him as a, you know, just another individual who's, you know, amongst a lot of people who are trying to change the general attitudes about what happened in the last century, you know, and the way...
Well, but here, let me just say this, that Fritz pointed out right in the beginning that when the IHR started, it was a anti-Holocaust propaganda institute. It was an organization
right.
to fight that.
And they realigned their focus, and I realized why you guys
they did.
Are
Mark,
mad about
Mark realigned it.
Mark realigned it all
Mark
by himself.
Mark realigned it.
Right.
And,
well...
And the point is that...
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I forgot now my next point. I do that. So go ahead.
No, I mean, I just think that, you know, what they're doing is... It's just like Greg Johnson and the debate you had with Greg Johnson. I think we're all in agreement about the problem here with Jewish power. And, you know, it's just how that power is expressed and what is the best way to counteract it is the real question here. And I think the Holocaust and debate, you know, and telling people the truth is important, but I don't feel like it necessarily has to be the main focus of effort and energy on behalf of any organization. And
it's not the main, Dan, it's not the main effort of anything, but it was the main effort of the Institute for Historical Review. And I was going to say, following the fact that it was Mark Weber who realigned that, then Robert Faurisson made the intelligent comment that since Mark Weber didn't want to talk about Holocaust anymore and didn't think it was all that important, he should resign from the Institute and allow someone else to take his place. And but that's not what he did. He decided he's hijacked the place, and then he's decided to change his focus, and that's what has got everybody so angry.
Once he got the money, then he figured he could change the direction completely. He got about as much money as he was likely to get from major contributors, and that's after that it was over as far as Holocaust revisionism revisionism was concerned for him. Yeah. And no one else at the IHR felt the way he did. Even Greg Raven and Tom Marcellus, all of these people recognized that the Holocaust was the primary focus of the organization. But you couldn't spell that out in the organizational bylines or anything like that. But everybody understood that. And Mark Weber understood that, too. But he betrayed everybody's trust with what he did. That's really monstrous, and I take it very seriously to this day, because I worked rather hard at times to help the IHR get established and become more influential. I raised a lot of money, and it was hard work. I had to fight in court for 2 years to get one estate settled. So,
I think that Mark Weber's not, this is not just his personal, it's his personal thing, but it's also, I have to see it as there, he's got some larger agenda.
To help himself. The large agenda is to help Mark Weber. Mark Weber thinks he is the greatest historian around, in this country at least. You know, David Irving might be the greatest historian in the world, but he's like number two in his thinking, and he's trying to help himself. It's very simple.
Okay.
I don't see why there isn't internal dissent if the situation is that disagreeable amongst the board members of the IHR. I mean, it can't just be an external criticism. And if he's a dictator and he's taking control of the organization and he can't be pushed out, you know, that's one thing. But I don't think the structure is built like that.
As it is, you can't have a meeting of the board of directors unless the chairman decides to call the meeting. So if Mark Weber doesn't even want to call a board meeting, you won't have a board meeting.
Mm. Yeah, he's the head of the board.
He's the chairman of the board.
Yeah. We've got 5 minutes, and I would like to let Germar close out what he would like to say. While we still have a little time, and your overall position or anything you'd like to say, Germar, to help clarify these things.
I think we should look into the future and pay less attention to Mark Weber.
I'm not going to.
It's malfocused. You should perhaps put your energy somewhere where it's constructive, not destructive, because that's not going to build anything new. We need to build something new. And I'm sure the things are progressing slowly but surely. Something new is being built. I see it from behind the scenes, and at some point things will improve without Mark Weber, and then we can see. That's all I'm going to say about that.
What is the time frame you're seeing here? How long do we have to wait for
A couple of years.
Well, I think we should keep working away, and I think we should try to neutralize Mark Weber, because he's going around saying these things. So if he's going to be going on radio programs, people should. And by the way, I wonder if they had, Charles, did they have any phone calls? Call in?
Yes, one fellow at 5 minutes before the first hour, I don't know if he read your questions, but he went after the Holocaust gas chambers, and he was pretty rugged. I had to cut him off, though, because I wanted to hear your program. So he was getting after Mark Weber, but Mark Weber was slipping through the cracks. That's why I said in his responses, I mean, he was slipping through the cracks, because he did say, I caught it just before your program started, that millions of Jews disappeared at Belzec, Treblinka, and Sobibor. And, you know, nobody was there to say, what's your evidence for that? How did they disappear? And so,
That's a standard Holocaust narrative.
That's been around for a while, but it changed, and for the better for our purposes, in the last year, when the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum suddenly came out with this story that 42,000 labor camps and concentration camps existed in the Soviet Union built and organized by the Germans, where Jews were put to work. That's where the Jews went from places like Treblinka and Belzec. They went to various labor camps throughout the German-occupied areas of the Soviet Union. 42,000 camps. That's a huge, huge number. Nobody even knew about that within our revisionist community, as far as I know, except possibly Carla Matonio, prior to this year. That's a huge admission. Okay, it used to be claimed that all of the Jews were concentrated in those six camps and then exterminated in huge numbers every day. And now suddenly there are 42,000 labor camps. One of them was even east of Stalingrad. In other words, further away from Germany. Jews were located there.
Okay, that's very good. I just heard the 60-second warning, and so I want to, I want to thank Germar, and I want to thank you, Fritz, and I want to thank Dana. I hope I didn't cut you off too much, and I want to thank you for being on this show tonight, and thank the callers, and thank you, Charles. You can just hang on here until the end. I'm not hearing the music. We're not going to hear the music because somebody had hung up, which I asked them to do. So, but we now have 30 seconds, so I guess I won't ask for any closing remarks from any of you, but you can say good night to the listeners.
Good night, and thank you for having me on.
And good night to all of you. I enjoy meeting Dana for the first time. I hope we hear more from you.
Yeah, I heard you on Deanna Spingola for it. So.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Well, all right, guys. Invite me on your show. Put me on your show someday.
Yeah, why don't you do that, Dana? Anyway. All right. Oh, there is the music. I do hear it.
All right, guys.
All right.
With you all.
Good night, everybody.
Take care.
Oh, the night.
Okay.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.